Walk foot and mouth with me. By the dustbins of Rome.
It's okay, folks. I ain't the master technician.
No, I am the master technician.
Wait a minute, Bottle. How long have you been a master tongue talking?
I'm not going to tell you, Echo.
Okay, Bottle. Okay, don't tell me. By the dustbins of Rome, when I found that murdery boy.
No, wait a minute. Don't leave me here in the dark. I tell you.
I don't want to know.
Come back, Echo. Echo, come back, Echo. Where are you?
I'm here.
I'm so glad you're here.
Silence! You got more applause than me. I got more clapping than me.
Men.
You got more tickets than what?
Men!
More to you.
Welcome to Goompod. As it's the first of a new series of Goompod, what better way to mark the occasion than by discussing the first episode of the Goon Show's seventh series with an old chum, friend of the show, and hip young gum flapper. It's Graham Lindsay Foot.
You leave my flapping gums out of this, young man.
Yeah, hello, Tyler. Great to be talking to you again.
Well, you're not quite a hip young gunslinger anymore, are you?
No,
let's face it.
Well, that's, you're as young as you feel.
Yes.
moving swiftly on.
Yes. Well, funny, just on that, because the day this goes out, it's the last day of my 40s. And I've got a custom-built bath chair being delivered with podcast recording equipment. And I've been.
I can see it all now. A wicker bath chair with a Marconi AXBT slung over the top of it, with BBC written on it. That's a beautiful idea. Yes, indeed.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
Panic not about the 50s. They're fine. Honestly, I've been in them for some years now. Yeah. 60 is going to be interesting. I mean, you know, you may be approaching 50, but you don't appear to be speeding, Tyler. That's the important thing.
I have been practicing scowling at young people. I think that's what is
I've done that all my life.
Graham, very good to get you back on the show. Last time we were speaking, it was to talk about the Lady Killers, I believe.
Oh yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
It's nice to be able to talk about things you like. And this, I think, is where we come in to today. I guess.
Yeah.
The Nasty Affair at the Barami Oasis.
So why this show? Why this particular show?
All right. Well, I think as long as with a lot of people of this age and certain age, the first introduction to getting hold of an awful lot of Goon shows was through the BBC LPs that were, you know, the Goon Show Classics series that were released.
Yeah.
Now, and I bought Volume 8 when it came out, I think, in the early 80s, I beg your pardon, about 1980, 81. And I bought it a year or two after that. So I'd be about 13, 14 years old when I bought this. Mm. Just because I tried my best, as indeed when you have become a goonatic, when you have been infected with the virus, you try your best to get hold of as many of these things as you possibly can. And I managed to get hold of the LP of this from the local shop in Wigan. Mm. And of course, on one side, it has got World War One. Mm. And on the other side, The Nasty Affair at the Barami Oasis. Now, this LP I still have in my possession, along with all the rest of them, and I nearly wore it out. Both sides of it. Partly because, I mean, I love World War One to distraction. It's one of my all-time favourite shows, but we're not talking about that today. It's a shame. Another time, perhaps, unless it's... Have you already done World War One?
No.
Yeah, well, should we survive this, then bookmark that for another time. But yes, and the other side of it, Nasty Fur at Barami Oasis, a good show. And the difference between the two, you can tell, is World War One was April 58. Not sure when it was, 8th series at least.
Yeah, it was one of the strongest shows from Series 8, wasn't it?
Yes, which is absolutely a definite curate's egg of a series.
Yeah.
Whereas 7, we're starting to get, we're in the middle of that mighty row of shows at the moment, you know, from 5 through the end of 7. And you can tell the difference between the two of them because, you know, 8 is wilder. This one is a nailed down show. To a great extent. And I reckon that's for a couple of reasons. One's the fact that Larry Stevens was involved with the script writing of this, I believe. Mm-hmm. And the other one is Peter Eaton. It's one of his last two shows that he produced with the boys.
That's right.
You know, so, and he was, shall we say, an old salty sea dog, you know. He wasn't entirely averse to giving the boys a good talking to and getting them back in shape.
Yeah,
when Patrick Kenneth McNeil Dixon came on from 7-3 onwards, he was such a nice chap, a lovely bloke, and just gave them free rein. He liked the Goon Show, and of course, from that point onwards, it starts to, you know, become mightily undisciplined. And of course, Series 8, Pat Dixon had left by this point. And
Eddie died at that point.
No, he died in October 58. He left to pursue a career in television production, but that obviously didn't last long. No, he was already poorly by the end of Series 7, but no, he died in October 58.
Because, of course, he'd come on board the Goon Show middle of Series 6, and then he was so busy working on other programs when the Series 7 was due to start that he requested a delay. Yeah. So he could have a holiday, I think. And then Peter Eaton very commendably agreed to step fill the breach. Is that the phrase?
Yes, indeed.
Because he was working for Granada as a producer.
That's right, yes. As a Granada producer up in Salford, yeah. But he came back for just two shows. And you can tell that the boys, in general, are behaving themselves. Not throwing things around the stage and dropping the trousers mid-broadcast or anything like that, mid-recording. So it's a quite a tight show because of that. And, of course, because you can see Larry Stevens has been involved with this, there's always, there tends to be a military air to whatever happens. Mm. There's always, you know, a military theme to whatever goes on. And the Nasty Affair at the Barami Oasis fits into that quite well, I think.
Well, Peter described this particular episode as he wasn't that keen on it. He said it was too bitty. I kind of see what he means.
Yeah, and yes, I know what you mean. It is a bitty episode. You know, it's episodic in the way that some of the earlier shows might have been. I guess, you know, there's a bit goes on here, a bit goes on there. Mm. But there's a theme. There's a, you know, there's a story arc of sorts. As much as there's a story arc in any Goon Show, you know. And of course, it's, you know, we can talk about all sorts of things as to why this show then as well. That's important stuff.
Well, this is because I can't remember the first time I heard the Nasty Affair at the Barami Oasis. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'll be honest, it's never been in my top 10 or top 20, but it's enjoyable enough. The thing that's notable about it, there's a recording of a rehearsal that they made.
A very rare thing indeed. Now, that's a beautiful thing, not only to have, but to listen to.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the way that it starts off, you know, as they're chatting about something that's been on the telly the previous night, you know, some comedy variety program.
Well, I can tell you about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it reminded me a bit, yeah, because you hear the lads chatting before Peter Eaton steps in and says, right, you know, come on, let's start working. Yeah. But you can hear them chatting about what they've watched on TV the night before. Yeah. And it reminded me very much of, you know, in Get Back, where George
Yes.
Is absolutely. Talking to Ringo and Michael Lindsay Hogg, I think.
That's it.
About what he'd watched on TV the night before.
Yeah.
So that's in, what, January 69. Yeah. And it was that, what's it called? Out of the Unknown.
Yeah.
So he's talking very enthusiastically about that TV show. And that's the most enthusiastic you see, George, I think. During this process.
And then he and Ringo say something along the lines of, yeah, no, there was some Wagner rubbish off after that, you know.
That's right.
Or whatever it was, you know. And yes, it was Wagner from Beirut. You know, absolutely, you know, beautiful, amazing high culture concert, which people just think, yeah, you know. But, you know, at the time. It's a very interesting little bit of cinema verite, absolutely.
And it just reminded me, so when I listened to this rehearsal recording of The Goons.
Yeah.
You've got Spike talking about what he'd watched on BBC television Saturday the 29th of September, that would have been.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first episode of something called Tess and Jim, which was screened under the Saturday Comedy Hour strand.
Yeah.
And it starred Tessie O'Shea,
mm-hmm.
Two-ton Tessie
Two-ton
O'Shea.
Two-ton Tessie, absolutely.
Yeah. And Jimmy Wheeler, and it also featured Charlie Drake. You could hear Spike describing a sketch from it where it was Caesar and Cleopatra. And he said something like Charlie Drake had a bit where he was holding an asp and it didn't seem to go as planned. I'm assuming a rubber asp.
Yeah.
I'm assuming.
What happened to the human test show last night?
What?
Human test. It was quite funny because
it was funny.
The sketch was funny because they...
such Caesar a little more funny. A little Charlie Drake. He was very funny.
Yeah,
he did a terrible thing though. Once you got this asp out, you got a snake out, and he shook it and what's that? Then they did this big dry, you see. It's quite a funny mix-up because they're such bad performers, and they know how to do it. They were trying to put up. Well, Cleopatra was given old Jimmy Wheeler, especially Caesar, a snake, you see. So put down this idiot Mark Anthony's shirt, and he's got a kilt on, Mark Anthony. A kilt and a breastplate, you see. And they come up with these about, we snakes around each other. And he said, something like, Jimmy, I'd like to embrace you. So he doesn't do all this. But Jimmy will learn to move when he said, don't go, well, I'm done.
And then Sellers mentions that he was watching ITV the night before, watching Ted Ray's TV show, which was unfortunately titled Hip Hip Hooray, and he says he just mentioned there was one funny sketch written by Sid Collin.
That's right, Sid Collin. He was up Pompeii. No,
what did Sid Collin? Rothwell, wasn't it?
Talbot Rothwell. Yes, no. Sid Collin wrote. Oh crumbs! Tipping me
loads of stuff.
Loads of stuff. Yes,
didn't he write for? Didn't he write for Morecambe and Wise in the early days?
Oh, you're not talking about Sid Green and Dick Hills, are you?
Oh,
please don't. This is a thing that I have got in. I know we rotate about various bits of comedy an awful lot these days, but I have an absolute pathological loathing of Hills and Green.
Oh.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh. Now, yeah, this is strange, you know, two of a kind, all of the stuff that they went through, from on the ATV series from 61 through 68. Mm. And, you know, the way that Hills and Green became almost sort of like hardy perennials, like Japanese knotweed, in all of their sketches. It was quite simple.
Oh, because, yes.
You know,
yes.
Because they're just there. I will forgive them. I will let them live for Gurney Slade, for the strange world of Gurney Slade, which is a glorious
absolutely
madness. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
But these two fairly unattractive guys just clog up every scene with them, you know, whether they're playing tennis or something like that. You don't let they don't let Eric and Ernie fly. Now, I'm sure they were very, very grateful to them for actually being, you know, like longtime script writers who could do these things. But I think there was a strike very early on in the ATV series, and, you know, so they couldn't get anybody else to act with them at the time. So Hills and Green came on and just stayed there all the way through the 60s.
And stank it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it's the best way of describing it. Yeah, indeed. And then when Eric had his heart attack in November 68, you know, they'd done the first BBC series by this point because they'd been promised colour And, you know, Lou Grade had said from ATV, so you'll have colour when I tell you you have colour. So they went over to BBC and said, can we have colour? And he said, oh, yes, please. Yes, fine. Go ahead. And they wrote the first series. And, you know, some of the ones that had been retrieved, they were on the box a couple of Christmases ago. And one of them is possibly the worst comedy sketch I've ever seen in my life on television. It was the Irish one. You know, the two lads all in an Irish bar talking about, you know, and this is about a year before the Troubles started.
Yeah.
And it's got every single, you know, whack me over the head with an old shillelagh joke in it you've ever seen in your life. Mm-hmm. And then Eric had his heart attack after the series one. And they, you know, Hills and Green thought, right, well, we need to make a living. He's not going to come back, is he? So they jump ship at this point.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think Ernie found out on a transatlantic flight that somebody, you know, gave him a newspaper or said, have you heard that your scriptwriters have left you? Mm. What? You know, and if, you know, you horrors.
Yeah.
Anyway, thankfully, Eddie Braben had just had a row with Ken Dodd about money, of course, and said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And the difference in the two eras of the 60s and the 70s, we'll say for the Eric and Ernie, the 70s started in 69 with series two, is like night and day for me, you know. And the great thing is the way that Eddie Braben wrote, he wrote them a full script with every single word in it. Whereas Malcolm and Wise's scripts, when they were with Hills and Green, they'd come, you know, Hills and Green had come in with a piece of paper with one or two words on it for ideas, and they just tossed it around until they had a script.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and they, you know, there was, you know, it was not a lazy way of writing, it just didn't suit Eric and Ern, and it certainly didn't bring out that lovely character of the pair of them. I told you I was going to digress, and I'm going to shut up right now because I've yacked on about one of my other obsessions far too much. Absolutely.
I just make this observation,
mm-hmm.
and people can feel free to send me nasty messages. I struggle with Morecambe and Wise.
Okay.
I really do. It's weird because I don't struggle with other British comedy. I mean, saying that, I struggle a bit with Tommy Cooper. The Two Ronnies, on the other hand.
Yeah, I like the Two Ronnies as well, very much. Obviously not as much as Malcolm and Wise, but yes, I do like them very much. I was always amused when I was reading From Fringe to Flying Circus, Roger Wilmot's fabulous book about this. We were talking about the way that comedy shows have developed over the years on the television. And they were talking about variety shows, you know, about the sketch variety. You know, this happens, that happens. Then you have a singer come on and then whatever else. And I remember at one point him making a slightly catty comment about, you know, as well, you know, variety comedy on the television these days seems to be dead and gone, except for the Two Ronnies who continue to inhabit the corpse. I thought, okay, yeah, no, I can see where he's coming from. It is an anachronism. But the point is that Ronnie Barker's writing is just so glorious.
Yes.
It's very, very funny. I'm afraid I've got a similar antipathy with Ronnie Corbett. I don't know why. It just gets on me wick. But nevertheless.
It's people say now, don't they, that it's almost like become a cliche. For people to say now, when I was a kid watching it, I used to hate the Ronnie Corbett monologue in the chair. Whereas now I'm older, that's the best part of the show.
Yeah.
To a degree, I kind of get that.
Yeah. It's strange, isn't it, how, you know, people's perceptions of what they were watching when they were younger and what was being presented as comedy at the time. Back to the Goons in 1985, that Goon show, you know, he goes into the antique shop and says, what was it like? You know, and said, oh, we had, you know, Raise a Laugh, Life with the Lions, the Clither O'Clid, or whatever it was, Kid, or whatever it was. Oh, it was terrible.
So we better start talking about the show. I'll give a little bit, as I always like to do, a little bit of sort of context to what was happening. Because it's the first episode of Series 7, broadcast 4th of October 1956. Now, so when this show goes out, the Ying Tong song, backed by Blood Knox Rock and Roll Call, was at number 4 in the charts. It peaked at number 3 in September. And in September, so, you know, the month before the show goes out, Spike and Eric recorded My September Love and You Gotta Go Owl with George Martin and the Alberts, of course.
Of course, the masked Alberts.
And Owl, in terms of Moriarty's, if you like, catchphrase, really comes into its own in Series 7, doesn't it?
Absolutely. He's all over it with in The Flea, I think, I seem to remember.
That's right.
Fairly shortly afterwards, indeed, yeah.
The TV series Son of Fred was roughly a third of the way through its run when the show goes out. Harry's had a hit. Well, I say a hit. He's had a recording released in September, which is from Rigoletto. I didn't actually make a note of what song
was it. La Donna Mobile?
Was that what it was?
Was it La Donna Mobile?
That'll be it.
If it's from Rigoletto, the chances are it's that.
That'll be it, yeah. And what else? So on the day that this goes out, Spike appeared on television very briefly on BBC TV, just before Wacko, on a short magazine program called Highlight, presented by Cliff Mitchellmore. So I'm assuming he went on to talk about the new series of The Goon Show, presumably.
Wouldn't it be wonderful to find out? Mm. Absolutely. You know, I rather liked old Cliff Mitchell Mouse. as he called himself from time to time. An interesting guy was Cliff Mitchellmore. He was, again, another hardy perennial all over television forever. You know, as I say, that the thing that he was with Spike, what did you call it again? What was it called? Highlight.
Highlight, yes.
Yeah, indeed. I don't know whether Tonight had started by that point, which he was one of the main anchormen for, which was the evening. I think that ran to about 1966, 67, something like that. And, you know, you think to yourself, he was, you know, quite a staid, owlish-looking kind of guy, was Cliff Mitchellmore. Mm. And the one wonderful occasion when you see, I think it's Bob Dylan appearing on the Tonight programme for the first time on British television, I think, 64.
Among the aficionados of American folk music, the name Bob Dylan, I'm told, is murmured with hushed respect. He it was who wrote the now famous protest song called Blowin' in the Wind. He's just arrived here to sing at the Royal Festival Hall, and his latest protest is called With God on Our Side.
Bob sings in his usual and inimitable style.
Yes.
Love it or hate it. I kind of like Bob Dylan.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, and at the end of it, they cut to Mitchellmore, and he's looking at the floor, and then he looks up with the most solemn, miserable expression on his face and just says, Bob Dylan. Just as if to say, well, I'm ever so sorry about that. It went out live. There's nothing I could do. I couldn't kill him on the camera, could I? You know,
there goes my career.
That's right, indeed. Yeah. But and then eventually, you know, Mitchellmore turns up on the holiday programmes all the way through the 70s and 80s and stuff like that, you know, looking avuncularly, you know, talking about, you know, holidays in Fuerteventura.
Very good.
But, okay. Yes, yeah, Spike was on with Cliff Mitchellmore, or Cliff Mitchell Mouse. And what else was happening in the world?
The day after the show goes out, the Ten Commandments premiered.
Oh, right. Okay. So anything that wasn't allowed to be mentioned on any questions that week wasn't actually happening in the world at the time. Okay, right. A Nasty Affair at the Barrowa and the Oasis. You will hear halfway through this. We're going to send a gunboat.
Yes.
Masses of cheers.
Yes.
The reason being is because the Suez Crisis was going on.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the reason, you know, the Suez Crisis was subject to a press embargo at the time. And that's the way that Spike got around it. There's an episode of Any Questions that had been on the home service a couple of nights beforehand. And
right.
Everybody in the audience wanted to talk about it, including one of the panelists whose name I can't remember.
Yeah.
And they said, at the moment, we've got this, you know, parliamentary embargo on reporting on this. And I said, you know, everybody knows what we need to be talking about. We're going to be breaking parliamentary rules here and parliamentary protocol and stuff like this and getting into trouble for it if we actually mention exactly what we want to talk about.
Yeah, okay.
And that's possibly a reason why this show was timed to come out at this particular time. You know, okay. We're going to send a gunboat, because that's exactly what the British government were going to do.
I listened again to the show this yeah. morning just to prepare, remind yeah. myself. Now, first of all, first question, is that grit pipe? Is that meant to be grit pipe?
No, not quite. I think it is grit pipe morphing into some sort of like pompous parliamentarian just for one line.
Just before we start talking about the show, actually.
Yeah.
Because we mentioned, or you mentioned, that it's written by Spike and Larry.
Mm.
Now, I was going to bring Julie Warren's book into this.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, I realise I've left it in another room. So I'm going to have to do this from memory. But yes. I know that there was some dispute about, or Larry wanted his name to be printed in, you know, he wanted to be credited in the Radio Times for as co-writer, and the BBC were unwilling to do this. And so Spike negotiated where he would be paid more and he would pay Larry out of his own pocket.
That's right. I think this is in the Andrew Pixley notes to the Goonshow Compendium.
Yeah.
Okay. Releases. Yes, I remember reading that now. That's where it was. Yeah. Yes, indeed. And this is the crazy thing. We'll go. Obviously, I know you've covered Larry Stevens with Julie Warren before. Mm. Spike could be, as we all know, not brilliant when it came to actually giving anybody else any credit.
Yeah.
You know, apart from the quote on the back of the book, you know, Spike, you know, Larry Stevens died, you know, very conveniently or whatever it was.
Mm, yeah.
And he was very tart about it, as about, you know, well, he did all right, you know, for being somebody who typed up my ideas or whatever it was. It was a nasty way of putting it. And, you know, I'm not going to give anybody any help, you know, anybody any credit, because I did it all by myself, he said at the Comedy Awards, half drunk, having just insulted Prince Charles at the time. Mm. And I think Stevens needs so much more credit.
Yes.
So much more credit for what he did. And as I say, the BBC's attitude at the time, they were hidebound in so many ways. Yes, they should. You know, he should have had his credit on this. Now, it was wonderful that Spike said, "All right, yes, there's some money for you. That's fine." But he was more than happy to continue keeping the credit for all of the work.
I think he kind of semi-grudgingly concedes that Eric did some good stuff with him.
Yeah,
but Larry just gets the rough end of the stick.
Completely, absolutely. Yeah. I'm trying to remember. Incidentally, I mean, Eric and Spike fell out after, I can't remember what it was. It was in Series 6 when they fell out.
Yeah. Because Eric wrote much of Series 5 with Spike, with or without Spike.
Yeah.
And then I think his last show was Tales of Montmartre, Series 6.
Charlotte Mitchell.
Yes.
And they parted their way, and he never wrote another one with him ever again after that.
No. They remained friends. If they fell out, they fell back in again, didn't they?
They forever, absolutely, yes. There's no question about that. But they couldn't work together after that point.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yes, no. So, yes, Larry Stevens needs certainly the acknowledgement of the work that he put into this one. And, of course, having the tone of it, because it's a military thing. In a military way. He wrote scripts in a military way.
Just staying on Larry briefly.
Yeah.
So, because it's the new series of The Goon Show, in the Radio Times that week, there was a short little puff piece, presumably written by Spike. Okay. And if you'll forgive me, I'm going to read this out. It's quite lengthy, but it's quite amusing as well. So, it's just basically the article begins, "Wanted, the Goons," and there's a photograph of the three of them lighting their cigarettes with a leak. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a profile of each of the goons, and it's got Spike. It says Spike Milligan, alias Eccles, Count Jim Moriarty, Minnie Bannister, Adolphus Briggs, and Larry Stevens. So he's managed to get Larry's name into the Radio Times that week.
Yeah, well, you expect it with Hugh Jampton, but you know.
Yeah.
You know,
it goes on, has numerous convictions, e.g. that the world is flat, that iron ships won't float. author of Sid Molth, Demon Plasterer, Her Secret Leg, etc., etc. Milligan was only 37 when he wrote his first song, The Little Old Dutch Time Bomb, Tick Tock Bang.
He mentions that in his war memoirs.
Yeah.
That's one of, you know, one of the crazy things that he mentions. He and Harry Edgington made up. You know, that, you know, he had all of these, you know, stupid names, but and one of them was Little Dutch Time Bomb, Tick Tock Boom, yes, or whatever it was.
He describes it as a novelty funeral march arranged for balalaika, gas guitar, bones, and E flat bucket. Then it goes on to Peter Sellers, alias Gritpipe Thin, Major Dennis Bloodknock, Henry Crun, William Mate, McRed, Harry McLegs, and Blue Bottle. Sellers, or to give him his incorrect name, Sir Grimbald Crab, was born in and was educated at, and is a man of whom Lord Nim said, which is hardly surprising, taking into account. Before becoming a professional immigrant, he was employed as, worked in, and later held the post of. He broods.
Right. He broods. Mm. Oh, how he brooded.
And then Harry Seacombe, alias Ned Seagoon, educated at Mill Hill Junior Mixed, Bulls Pond Road, Senior Girls, and Swansea Municipal Baths, where he studied drowning under Professor O.J. Pules Bladdock QC, and also underwater. A singer of conviction, for humming without due care and attention, he has a criminal record at present, number 57 on the Hat Parade, and is persona non grata with Councillor Mrs. Spavey's Foldy Rolls. So unpick all that.
I love it when he comes out with these Pules Bladdock names. That's a good name. Pules Bladdock. Pules! That comes up from time to time, that does.
So what I wanted to do was just to run through what happens in this show, just a pre-see, if you like, or a lengthy summary. Mm-hmm. Slightly lengthy summary, and then you and I can just talk about bits and pieces, what we like, anything that anything that jumps out. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the British garrison at the Barami Oasis is under attack from Shake, Rattle and Roll, which is a hilariously punning name, and well, not achingly topical, because the song was in the charts in 1954, and Ray did a version of it.
He did absolutely. Well. Shake Marilyn Monroe.
That's it, yeah.
As he sang, yes.
Shake, Rattle and Roll. I never liked the fact that he's called Shake, Rattle and Roll.
No.
But anyway. And the show is, it's like you say, I mean, there's undertones of Suez, but it's inspired by the dispute at El Baraimi, or Baraimi. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
which
indeed.
Lies on the border of the UAE.
Oman.
In the north, and Oman to the south.
That's right.
And it's about a dispute with the British. Oh no, it was between Saudi Arabia, Oman, and the UAE, with the British on the Oman side. Are you following this?
I am indeed. Yes, I think they were a protectorate at the time.
Yeah. It had ended the previous year, but tensions were still high, and the kind of things petered out towards the end of the decade. And then, it's Middle East politics, and this is not that sort of podcast.
Okay? Oh, no,
it's certainly not. We ain't straying into that. But it's to do with obviously the political climate at the time. And we have Admiral Neddy Seagoon, commander of the battleship HMS Thespis. He's called up to fill the woeful lack of sailors in the army.
How dare you insult a man wearing the Queen's open neck shirt, flannel trousers, flat cap, and boots?
I'm so sorry. I beg your pardon.
You don't seem to realize. I've served on board the HMS Thespis since my father died. You see, the HMS Thespis is a family business. Father put it in his wife's name.
What was her name?
HMS Thespis.
What was her maiden name?
The Yarmouth Belle.
How she must have suffered.
What?
Now, HMS Thespis, does Thespis mean anything to you?
It doesn't, I'm afraid, no. I'm sure it's, you know, I'm sure it has a relevance at the time, but I don't know.
Thespis was the god of theatre and theatrical performers.
Ooh.
And as a mischievous spirit, apparently, according to myth, and causes things to go wrong during a performance. So there you go. And the Yarmouth Belle still exists. It was a Thames pleasure launch built in 1892 by Thomas Bradley. for his own use, and it's still going strong, I believe.
Fabulous. A rare thing.
Intelligence reveals that the Barami garrison are scheduled to play football against the Arabs next month. The attacks are designed to tire the British men to guarantee an Arab football victory. Which, again, it's reminiscent of the Whistling Spy enigma.
Very much so, indeed. Yeah, the England and Hungary, as it was at the time. And, you know, let's put dynamite in the football boots or whatever it was. Yeah. Yes, exploding football boots.
That was the first episode of Series 5.
Yeah. Well, hopefully long enough by which people might have forgotten that bit.
Yeah.
that's two series ago. Let's revamp something. So I'll tell you what, let's do the Whistling Spy enigma again with Suez involved. Yes.
Well, they also reference the Hungarian football team in Ye Bandit of Sherwood Forest.
They do indeed. Five. Yes, they do.
So the chiefs of Army, Navy and NAFI decide to send a gunboat, as we said earlier.
They're going to send a gunboat.
42,000-ton HMS Thespis is duly broken down into 4-inch squares and sent to Barami.
Could have marked date fertilizer this way up.
What the hell is date fertilizer?
It's just something you put, you know, well, obviously, you know, going to the Middle East, I suppose dates grow there. And so it would be something that you would put around the base of a date bush, I guess. And we all know what makes roses grow. So,
oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. So. Now, this is the Colonel Gritpipe Thin and his accomplice Moriarty hear of the scheme and inform the Sheikh, who tells them that they'll get no more money unless the Arabs win the football match.
Mm.
Now, right. So, but didn't we heard Gritpipe earlier shouting about the gunboat. So why is he only now hearing about the scheme?
Well, obviously, he's one of two things, either a script anomaly or he's being his usual devious self.
Yes,
I think there's plenty of that about Gritpipe. You know, don't put it past him. He's a cat. You know, I think he's if indeed what you say is, you know, he starts to come out with this different voice, we're going to send a gunboat, then it could be him. I'm not sure. I think I'd have to have another listen to the rehearsal on that one. In point of fact, now that's an interesting thing. Can we talk about the rehearsal now? Would you want to do that?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, sure. When I listened to this, obviously it's only 20-odd minutes long because, you know, the boys haven't arrived for the musical breaks yet. Max and Ray haven't arrived. So they've, you know, they rattle through it quite quickly. Obviously there's no audience reaction. And it's incredibly flat.
Yes, it is.
It's so flat, you know, that the rehearsal is there and you think to yourself, how on earth does that turn into the goon show that we know and love? You know, the only person who seems to be enjoying himself is Harry, you know, who you could, you know, wave a twig at and he'd laugh. bless him, you know, and God love him for it, you know, absolutely. You know, you can hear him, you know, hooting and cackling away quite a lot through this. Peter's as flat as a pancake. Spike, he tries his best, you know, he's keeping it going. And that's cool, you know, but on the whole, the whole atmosphere is very, very muted all the way through that rehearsal. And of course, at one point, because Ray hasn't arrived yet, I think Spike has to play his part at one point off mic.
He does.
You know, so, you know, you have to shout, you know, whatever he was doing, you know, hello, Barami Oasis, hello, mate, you know, all that sort of thing. Yeah. And Spike's playing that part as well. But I was amazed when I heard that. I'd heard it years ago. I'd had a fuzzy tape of it that the late great Paul Geraghty, who used to be the Goon Show Preservation Society Northwest titular head, he used to lend me tapes and give me tapes and whatever else to copy or whatever, and they always sounded as though he'd been cleaning his heads with sandpaper.
I think,
you know,
I heard those tapes as well.
Oh man, you know, stuffed at the end of a 100-yard tunnel, stuffed with cotton wool. It was like, you know, what did he say? You know, what show are we listening to again? You know, what's my line? Is it? I don't know. So I remember hearing this a long time ago, and I think I remember giving up on it at the time. But of course, because you've got the lovely new modern trendy recordings that have been restored, you listen to it now, and yes, you can tell that they're not mucking around very much. Peter Eaton is still casting a beady eye on them as well, keeping the discipline.
All right, Ash, here we go.
So yes, let's get through this, boys, sort of thing, you know, let's start.
Hey! My knees are falling now.
Never mind, lad, here, have a fresh pair. I always carry them since that dreadful affair at the Mr. Flesh contest 1956.
Now, come along, lift.
Ladies and gentlemen, with only two men to carry the battleship, an unexpected time lapse has occurred in the program. To fill it, Ray Ellington, who up to now has been playing the part of Sheikh Aleg, will now play the drum part in his quartet. That was the Ray Ellington Quartet. Music lovers can come out now. Here's a lithograph of the Bangalore Prize Tin Band listening to the disgusting affair at the Barami Oasis, part the Equinox. Dum, 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 dum.
Once afloat in the Oasis, the battleship dropped anchor. All sailors on board were cunningly disguised as Arabs.
Just before dawn, 2,000 Arabs, cunningly disguised as sailors, crept up to the Oasis, performed a certain deed, and crept away again.
Going back to my original point, I'd have to have a listen back and see whether it is grit pipe earlier on. But of course, I think it is.
I think he's
just being his usual devious self, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's the first recording that they've done together for many, many months. Mm. And so maybe they're a little bit rusty. Or maybe they bring out the A game when they actually begin recording with an audience. Plus, yes, I suppose having an audience adds to it, of course, doesn't it, as well?
Of course, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this would be mid-afternoon and the brandy hadn't even broken out by this point, I shouldn't even imagine.
Mm.
You know, that's it's one that wonderful... comment. I think that's always the third part of the. I think Harry said this. The third part of any show is always the most incoherent, because we've had two musical breaks to go around the back for the old brandy by this point. But you know, are the goons? Ah, there's a thesis for anybody if everybody wants to. Are the goons funny when sober? Discuss.
Well, Harry put it away.
Oh, by God, absolutely. Of course,
could. More than the other two, I guess.
Mm. Indeed, Spike was one for his fine wines.
Yes.
You know, eventually, you know, sellers went onto the jazz cabbage. But, you know, those naughty jazz woodbines.
There's a couple of things on the rehearsal recording that don't feature in the show, but are actually in the script, obviously.
Mm.
There's an interesting bit. I don't know if you picked up on it,
which
wasn't included in the show that went out, but... Mm. There's one line just after the brief appearance by Minnie Bannister.
Mm.
There's a line for a character called Pure Heart. And
I missed this.
Yeah, and it's not included in the show, but Peter does do a Benteen voice on the rehearsal recording.
I wonder why that was jettisoned. Yes. Mm. Let's break all contact with the past, says Spike. It's my show, not Spike, not Mike's. Perhaps a lot of that about it, I guess. I don't know.
It wasn't even a funny line. It was just like, I don't know. Hang on, what was the line? Let me just bring it up. Hang on a second. Okay. Harry says in the script, we must recover the water from the Arabs to refloat this ship. And then it's got Peter, brackets Pure Heart. The question is, which way did they go, sir?
The question is, which way did they go, sir?
Yeah, I do remember hearing that now. And I thought, that's a non sequitur. What do you mean? Don't get that.
No.
Well, it's a line that didn't work, so it was struck. That's absolutely fine. But curious that it was Pure Heart.
Mm-hmm. Hey, speaking of Benteen.
Yeah.
Graham.
Hello.
Graham.
What?
You're the sort of fella that would love to hear a clip of Michael Benteen and Les Dawson arguing with each other in Spanish.
Oh, tell me about it. I would love that.
Un día comí con mucho dinero por comamente porque adesso comedia.
No, otro en el hospital.
¿Qué por qué?
¿Qué pasa?
¿Qué pasa de qué pasa?
Es la regla de Inglaterra en un hospital.
Se colpe que estudio de televisión por inglés, ¿eh? ¿Qué malo es con usted?
Que estaba comiendo un gringo. ¡Qué locosísimo!
You're fish and chips.
Pero de no.
Wow, that was amazing.
Wasn't it just?
I wasn't expecting that.
No. There you go.
Oh, thanks for that, Ty. Appreciate
it. Let's crack on. So just going back to the story, Sheikh Rattler Roll back at the Barami Oasis is trying to collect back rent from Major Blacknut. Now, back rent, back pay, outstanding monies is a recurring theme in the Goon Show, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. This is always, that's an old army thing again, of course, whether it's a Larry Stevens thing, but I think it's most definitely a Spike thing. You know, Spike, you know, obviously by this point, you know, he was married, he had children, he had bills to pay. And, you know, the strain of the Goon Show, of course, is the only way in which you could actually pay those bills. You know, that was the thing that actually brought the money in. And of course, you know, he said years and years later, you know, I gave my sanity to that show. And, you know, you can imagine when you've got, you know, several small children at home and having back pay, you know, having to, you know, meet the bills is a recurring theme. It's a strange thing. You know, Spike always talks about money, even though, you know, by the end of his life, I'm sure he had plenty of it. I don't know his financial circumstances. I'm not interested either. But, you know, there's always people who are absolutely on the knees financially all the way through this, you know, even, you know, in Pocoon, two ragged-assed, you know, idiots or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, with, you know, we're coming to that point, incidentally, where, you know, instead of, we've already been, is it, when does Moriarty start to talk about money? That's the point. He's already going, ow, by this point, because he's trying to get another record sold. But when is it money later? I think it might.
I think it is.
Yes, he starts to talk about money. You know, Shelby. You know, is everything is to do with money. And by the end of it, of course, Grit Pipe has reduced him to a cringing wreck. No, which one of these fish bones is you? So, yes, there's an awful lot about back pay and money all the way through this.
Yeah.
And that's a very, very British thing. You know, the British landlord has come round, you know, knocked on the door and said, yes, it's time to get your rent, time to club, man, stuff like this.
Yeah.
And of course, that would be a common thing in Catford or Lewisham or wherever Spike ended up, you know, when he first came to this country. You know, these are things, formative experiences for him.
Yeah.
It's not, I don't think it's a chip on his shoulder, but it's a recurring theme that I think he's trying to exorcise, perhaps. About the fact that, you know, people have to pay people rent and money and things like this, meet the bills.
And I suppose rationing had ended a couple of years before, hadn't it?
Yeah, it had.
Which reminds me, right at the top of the show, you've got Spike trying to introduce this catchphrase for the show, which is, excuse me, what is the price of sliced ham per portion? Which I think, I mean, on the rehearsal, he just says it straight. And then the broadcast version, he gets a round of applause. And you get the impression, because there's a lot of sniggering and corpsing going on. You get the impression that's probably like the 8th or 9th take that he's managed to, he's finally managed to get it out, if you pardon the expression.
It's funny to hear Wallace Greenslade's reaction straight after that. You know, during the rehearsal, he says, what if the place is a small portion? That's fine. But it suddenly becomes upper-class twit for this. Excuse me, tell me the price of sliced ham per small portion.
Yeah.
And you know, Greenslade goes, I really couldn't say. Blast! And then you hear Greenslade break character just for a second.
Yes, well.
You know, like that. And he's one, you know, and that's it. And there's this huge roar of laughter and applause of it. And then he comes back to the night, yes, well, anyway. And it just starts to do the show at that point.
Excuse me. Excuse me. What is the price of sliced ham per portion?
I really couldn't say.
Blast.
Yes, well, now, this is the BBC Home Service.
I don't know. It might have been something to do with rationing. Was there a problem? You know, if anybody fancies, you know, if they've got the rest of their life spare, they can troll the papers and say, was ham going up in price at the time because of the end of rationing? I don't know.
Well, Spike had a bit of an obsession with pig products, didn't he, in terms of, obviously, you've got Blue Bottle's sausages. Yeah?
Sausages, yeah.
And what became of the crispy bacon we had before the war? any other pig-related lines?
Off the top of my head, no. I'm trying to think when he became a vegetarian. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Perhaps I don't know when he, I don't think he was, he was still smoking at this point, I think. Mm. And, you know, he hadn't gone vegetarian by this point. So I don't know is a very good question. Mm. You know, but certainly he was vegetarian by the 1970s. Most definitely the early 70s, yes. Because, you know, I think he's one of his war memoirs. You know, he's talking about somebody, you know, one of his colleagues, you know, shoveling pieces of dead pig into their mouth. And you think to yourself, yes, that's the sort of thing that somebody who doesn't eat meat anymore would say.
Absolutely.
But yes. I don't know, but the price of sliced ham for a small portion, I have no idea what goes on. And it's said an awful lot more during the rehearsal.
It is.
They've cut a few of those out. If it was a way to try and introduce a character... or a catchphrase, I should say. I don't know what the intention was because, as you say, it's not particularly funny. It's all right. You know, this is just somebody pompous, somebody random coming in and saying, "What's the price?" Yeah, fine, okay, go away. But let's get on with the show.
It's the first episode of a new series. You think he'd want to have a real stonker of a belly laugh right at the beginning.
Yeah,
and instead it's just this sort of non sequitur.
It, remember, of course, the first thing that you hear is Fred the Oyster.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah.
And that is a good way to start any show. You know, that's Fred the Oyster is just the most glorious sound effect. I don't know if you've covered it in other shows or anything like that, but this is, for me, I've got it on my phone.
Have you?
Incredible, yeah, absolutely.
Ringtone?
Yeah, well, I can't because it's iPhone, so unfortunately, oh, I can't make it talk to it. You know, I used to have Androids, and I had it as a ringtone at one point. but indeed, I know that there's somebody who may or may not be listening to this show, a guy called Jim Exley, who has managed to get hold of an original 78 of this in the last year or so. Wow. Yes, it's a Columbia sound effect. It was released, oh, crumbs, late 30s, early 40s. Serial number YB20. If anybody's looking out at a boot fair one day for it.
Very good.
Columbia. And you will see, you know, there are four bands on it. And it's like one, you know, one baby crying, one donkey. It's all it says. It just says donkey. It's hardly of this world. It's such an odd noise.
It is.
And it's such a funny noise. Even, you know, they brought it in. Oh, very, you know, what's Sinking of Westminster Pier.
That's right. We talked about it then.
Yeah, indeed. It appears then, and it even appears in the final Goon Show, if you listen to the last Goon Show of all. You hear them falling about during the rehearsal for this.
It turns up in The Magic Christian, for Christ's sake.
Does it? I haven't heard that. Oh,
you've got
it's a
Sellers,
long time since I've seen that.
When there's the sort of the climax of the film, if you like, when they think the ship is sinking, all the passengers are panicking, and you've got all these announcements go, do not panic, you know, or whatever. And then you've got Sellers as Bloodknock saying, now hear this, and you get Fred the Oyster.
Oh, that's glorious. I've heard it in the wild in one other place, Goon-related, yeah. And this was, I hate bringing it up in a comedy Goon Pod.
By the way, sorry, Graham.
Yeah.
Listeners may be hearing some extraneous noise. It is my neighbour who has chosen this precise moment to start mowing her front lawn. So thanks for that.
Well, the weather's fine for it, absolutely.
But I interrupted you, sorry, Graham.
No, it's fine. Yes, Little and Large. So there I've said it. Please don't turn off. Please don't turn off. Please don't turn off. Please don't turn off. Little and Large. No, I'm going to stop saying their names because it will make people turn off. I remember that for whatever reason, it was on the television sometime in the early 1980s and I was watching it. I don't know why. Perhaps I was ill or insane. I'm not sure. And there was a moment where they used that sound effect as, you know, I think it was a food caravan. For whatever reason, in one of their sketches, collapsed. Or something like that. You know, it was some horrible thing happened to it. Unfortunately, they didn't die during it, but nevertheless. And I remember as this thing tipped over and, you know, all chaos and crashing glass, you heard Fred the Oyster being used in the background.
Right.
And I think to myself, that must be somebody, it's a BBC production, somebody is trying to inject something funny into this show.
Well, I always get them mixed up with Cannon and Ball. Was it Eddie Large that used to do Harry Secombe impressions?
Yes, indeed. Harry Secombe's car starting and everything else, and Tommy Cooper's car starting and stuff like that. Now, Cannon and Ball had a little bit more to them, most definitely. I think they had some talent, quite a lot of talent, and they worked hard at their trade. Mm. And at their best, they were adequate, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Little and large were an anomaly and an aberration, which, I'm sorry, Cyril, if you're listening, you were a product of the time, and I'm rather glad you're not on the telly anymore. Years ago, a dear late friend of mine I was at university with, we used to write sketch comedy. And one of them, it was just like a mixture of Doctor Who and whatever else. And we managed to clone Sid Little in this. And we had a whole band of Sid Littles wandering across this, you know, like zombies, all saying, "Will you give over? I'm trying to play me song. Will you give?" You know, and you can imagine the, you know, the sound effect of, you know, 8,000 of them all overlapping with each other. You know, "Will you give over?" Please.
Seagreen arrives at the Oasis, and Eccles and Bluebottle reassemble the battleship, which is no mean feat, as the Oasis is only 10 feet long, so it requires the battleship to be stood up on one end, which is why the show was never adapted for the Tallygoons, I guess. just before dawn, 2,000 Arabs, cunningly disguised as sailors, take away all the Oasis water. Seagoon nonetheless navigates the battleship over sand to the Sheikh's fort, where he ambushes the Sheikh, Gritpipe, and Moriarty. And there's a standoff when Gritpipe threatens to have his men drink the Oasis water until Bloodnock phones Seagoon to tell him that the water is actually 20,000 gallons of gin that Bloodnock stored there. Which I worked it out, that equates to 100,000 bottles of gin.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you'd probably lose a good quarter of it due to sand absorption. Yes, it's really bad idea for a storage area, isn't it?
Thankfully, knowing more about gin than I do about the topology of oases, then you may well be right. There may be there may be an equation to be drawn there, but I think there would have been enough to go around.
See,
what about the tonic?
Also, right, it's the first time we hear the mention of gin. Now they
is
should
it
have
really.
They should have. As in the show, there should have been some gag earlier on with Bloodnut where he's talking about all this gin that he's got to, you know, for it to properly pay off. But anyway,
you're right. Sorry, I thought you meant in the Goon Show proper. They probably did mention gin many times over the series.
They did.
But yes, indeed. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. This sounds like an afterthought. You know, we've got this far. We've got this standoff. What happens next? You know, that'll do. That's fine. That'll do. And it's actually quite a fun payoff when you hear the final score.
It is. Because Seagoon calls Gritpipe's bluff, and the Arabs unwittingly drink 20,000 gallons of each gin. But also it's got echoes of drinking a large body of water. What they think is water is echoes of the treasure in the lake.
Yeah,
from series 6 and the a very Q first, sketch.
The very first show I ever heard was The Treasure in the Lake.
Right.
And I adore it because of that. Yeah, and that is a fun show. Just for the one reason, you know, he's lying on the, you know, Gritpipe and Moriarty have persuaded Seagoon to drink the lake because it says it has this health restoring properties and make, you know, like the fountain of youth. You know, just lie on the floor. Neddy, you know, now put this other end of the hose in your mouth. Moriarty, put the end in the lake. Now suck away. And he just carries on. Ah, the water level's going down. And at one point, Harry says, "I have to stop. I'm feeling faint." "Faint? You feel faint? Here, drink this glass of water." Adore that. That's a lovely, lovely moment. But yeah, we're talking about the Arabs drinking 20,000 gallons of gin. You hear a great sound effect at this point. You know, there's an awful lot of bubbling and an awful lot of glugging going on. Yeah, and you think to yourself, how on earth did the sound effect guys pull that together within, you know, 10, 15 minutes or whatever else of notice of saying. Yes, Spike, can you have 20,000 Arabs or whatever it is drinking an Oasis?
Please? Did they just record Harry Secom in the wings?
Well, I wonder how he got his training for that. It's probably with Menace Drain Wilson, I should imagine. Who could knock it away? God rest him. I remember seeing him at the Bournemouth Goon Show convention back in 1995, and he was still on the bitter in those days.
Yes.
Bless the old man. Yeah.
So the show ends with the Arab football team staggers onto the pitch, in no condition to play, and the result is a foregone conclusion. British garrison 12, drunken Arab 68.
Which just goes to prove that gin is a dash good drink. Good night. And that's it. Smash it. And a big, beautiful play out to end as well. It's, as you say, it's not a top league show. I think it's an adequate show. Why they chose that one to put on the back end of Gunshow Classics Volume 8 is a strange one. It works well. It works well enough. I can see what was said about it being slightly episodic and a bit bitty. Peter Easton has said that, he said, yeah.
That's right, yeah.
But nevertheless, I think it holds together quite well. It's got a nice feel to it, is the best way of describing it. And it's quite obvious that the boys are enjoying themselves, especially, as I said, right at the beginning. When, you know, straight after This Is the BBC, Fred the Oyster, and then Spike, excuse me, giggles. Lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of giggles.
Indeed.
Before he actually manages to, you know, bring himself around to actually say the line.
I know I've sort of powered through that summary of the show, but in terms of highlights for me,
yeah,
I think the Eccles and Blue Bottle sequence is wonderful.
That is lovely. Absolutely, you know. But with the bit I'm not going to tell you, don't tell me. And, you know, Eccles wanders off.
All right, I'll tell you. Come back, Eccles. Eccles, come back.
Where are you?
I'm here.
You know, that's it. You know, it's incredible mic work there. It's beautiful. You know, they'd learned the tricks of the trade by this point. And, you know, it was Peter Eaton, of course, who taught them this mic technique and radio technique. Mm. You know, how to paint a sound picture just using, you know, BBC microphone.
Well, Eccles is uncommonly bitter by the fact that Blue Bottles got a round of applause.
Yeah.
And
I didn't get any clapping. That's right, indeed. He is Dutch. Now that's curious. Yes, Eccles with a weed on, as me missus would say, you know.
Yeah. And he's singing, what's he singing? By the Dustbins of Rome.
That was what was the original? By the Fountains of Rome, I think it was, wasn't it? That was a hit at the time. By the Dustbins of Rome, where I found it.
It was a hit by David Hughes, who was a Welsh tenor.
Indeed.
Backing orchestra was Wally Stott.
Wally Stott.
Mm.
Angela Morley.
Yeah. This we won't dwell on it, but there is some racially insensitive language in this show.
I was shocked to hear this. Obviously, I had the original Goon Show Classics BBC edit. Yeah. It was 27 minutes.
Yeah.
And when I heard the Goon Show Compendium version, the beautifully restored version, you think to yourself, oh, man, yeah, that's never going to be broadcast again. Mm. An awful lot of racial phrases, words, which is simply and not acceptable now. Yeah. They would have been probably on the border of being acceptable back in the 1950s, but how times have changed and how attitudes have changed. Oh, for the better, I pray. But even so, it was incredible to hear it, you know, during the rehearsal and indeed, you know, during the show proper. And these, you know, it just went without mention, without any comment or anything like that. It's just what it was at the time. I was pondering purchasing a copy of Spike Milligan by Humphrey Carpenter.
Oh yes,
have you got that right? I was, you know, thinking if I can pick up a second-hand copy of that somewhere. And he lays into Spike quite heavily about this, I believe.
Yes,
about his attitudes.
Yeah,
but they were the attitudes of the Raj, the British Raj, of which he was at the tag end of. You know, he was a product of the tag end of that. It's not an excuse; it's a reason.
Yeah,
you know, that's all it is. I think it's the best way of describing that. But yes, no, there is. It is of its time, shall we say? And because of that, yes, it'll. I don't think it'll ever be broadcast again. Okay. If you want to listen to the show, get the Goon Show Classics LP.
Yes, yeah.
Most definitely.
The offending words are removed. And Ray, obviously, Ray's playing Shake, Rattle and Roll in this episode, and there's a nice little reference where he says he needs the money, married recently.
Yes.
Um, So Ray had got married in real life to the actress Anita West.
Anita West, who ended up on Blue Peter.
Yeah. I didn't really know much about Anita West, so I did what everyone does, went on Wikipedia.
Yep.
So how accurate this is, I'm not sure. But she was only on the programme for 16 editions.
Correct.
I believe. And she voluntarily resigned from the series because of her imminent divorce in 62 to Ray.
Mm.
And she felt that it was unseemly for a presenter of Blue Peter to be a divorcee.
Yeah, that sounds like an excuse for saying, yeah. Listen, I'm going through some hell at the moment. I don't want to be on this program anymore. Let me go and get my life sorted.
She is the mother of Lance Ellington.
Of course, indeed.
Now, what else is there to talk about? Oh, as they introduce Max, you've got Peter going, hello, boy. It's like semi-Blue Bottle voice.
Mm.
But he does it. He does it in the rehearsal as well.
Yeah,
that's just a nice little impression of Max. It doesn't really sound like Max, though, does it?
It is. Hello, boys. Mm. Yeah, that's right. It's you know, what did he call him during? You know, I think it was in The Call of the West, the world's worst actor.
That's right.
I think they called Max. I have got a huge amount of time for Max Gildray. Apart from the fact that he was a great player, you know, and you know, with the Wally Stott or Angela Morley Orchestra, his jazz playing is off the scale. There is one photograph of him with Django Reinhardt, who's my absolute all-time hero, well, guitar hero, I should say. And I'd love to have known if there were any recordings out there. I've gone through Django Reinhardt's catalogue, and I don't think there's anything with Max on it, as far as I'm aware.
Mm.
Which is a bit of a shame. Perhaps Philip Gildray, if he's listening to this, could let us know. I don't think he would, but I don't think so. But no, back in the 1940s, if you've ever read Goon with the Wind, that's a super book, Max's autobiography.
Mm. No, I haven't, but
it's a good, it's very interesting. You know, about his escape from occupied France in the 1940s and stuff like that, and how tight it was for him.
Right. Flower Jew, discuss.
Oh boy. At this point, you know, I would almost be tempted to use one of his lines. Oh, shut up, you, it's perfectly quiet to you, came along. Is Flower Jew is a great little character. I don't know, you know, who he's based on. We know who he was based on to. Yeah, whether they were people that he knew or there was like an urban myth. Sellers knew about Flower and Dew, that's right. Mm. The great one that he says on Parkinson, isn't it? I say your handbag's on fire, that one.
Yeah.
It's a good, but, you know, run up a flag, I'll get the sewing machine, sir. Yes, sir. That's right. A good line.
Yeah.
I like Flower Dew when he turns up, because he always gets a laugh.
Yeah,
but it's not a cruel laugh. You know, Flower Jew is always on the up on these things, or he's always on the attack, or he's always, you know, he's not,
He's not passive, is he?
He's not passive, not by any means. No, no, no.
No.
I like him. I like him as a character.
Mind your language. There may be sensitive Scots guardsmen present.
It's all right. I don't mind, really. Honestly, it's quite all right.
Sellers! How dare you change your voice from mine into his for one joke only?
He crops up again later, Flower Jew, when everyone's disguised as chickens, and he says, I think someone's overacting. We've just found an egg. Again, listening to it just before, the scene before that scene, the shake, rattle and roll rides off on a chicken.
Yes.
And then we have the scene where everyone's disguised as chickens. It just seems a bit bizarre that you'd have chicken twice.
Well, yes, it's nice, you know, the reason why he rides off on his chicken, you know, it gives, you know, Sellers the opportunity, his blood not to, so, you know, he's not so doing well riding his lunch, you know, which it's a good enough line, I suppose. Mm. Chickens are always funny, again, yeah. It's, you know, it's like dustbins, you know, they appear an awful lot. And the thing about them doing the lineup, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, yeah, that's him. What's that chicken away? Is great. That was something I noticed, incidentally, with the rehearsal and the show itself. Harry gets the line wrong on both occasions. You know, somebody says, you can't be too careful. And then Harry says, pardon me, and then starts clucking. And then Sellers comes in as Flower Dew. Pardon me, sir.
Oh.
And he does it in rehearsal as well.
Oh.
I reckon it must have been scribbled very badly on the script, that Maybe. Bit.
Immediately on arrival at the Oasis, we began to open the crates, having first disguised ourselves as chickens. You can't be too careful. Pardon me.
Pardon me, sir. I think somebody's overacting.
Why?
We've just found an egg.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, if you ever listen to that, you know, Harry gets a rare, well, is it a rare miscue? Who's the, here's a question. Who of the three goons gets the most miscues, gets the most fluffed lines? Who, you know, who's the person out of the three of them? Discuss again.
Probably Sellers, I would have
probably
thought.
Sellers. Possibly.
Funny enough, on the rehearsal tape, he mispronounces Magdalen College as Magdalen, doesn't
Magdalen
he?
Magdalen College, himself. Yes, he does.
Good morning. Here is the news. The Barami Oasis situation has deteriorated. The British garrison is under constant attack from Sheikh Rattlin Roll. Sheikh Rattlin Roll, you will recall, was sent down from Magdalen College, Oxford, for attacking the British garrison there.
And one wonders about that, you know, who wrote the phrase Magdalen College? That sounds like a Larry Stevens line. And Larry Stevens was far more educated than any of the other three goons. Spike, of course, became very erudite in later years and stuff like this.
Yeah, but he was an autodidact, wasn't he?
Very much so, absolutely. Yeah. Whereas Harry and Peter, I'm not sure so much. I mean, they weren't thick by any means, not by any stretch of the imagination. But you wonder about the, you know, the level of the education.
Sellers always appeared to me the sort of man who probably never read books, and yet, there's at least two films I can think of that were which he sort of he'd read the books and wanted. Mm. To make the films, there's The Magic Christian, which he was hawking that around. I think he gave a copy of it to Kubrick, didn't he?
I think so.
And of course, Being There was based on a book which he adored. So he obviously did read a bit.
Obviously. But, you know, perhaps that was later in life. I don't know, you know. But, you know, obviously we knew that his education wasn't brilliant because of his, you know, Bill and Peg, his mum and dad, you know, hawking him around, you know, various, you know, music halls all the way through his childhood and stuff like this.
Yeah.
Then, you know, I don't know. It's an interesting thought. But, you know, as I say, you know, Spike most definitely an autodidact.
Yeah.
But, that was a thing. When he was having his first nervous breakdown in 1953, during Series 3, I can't remember who it was. Well, I think it might have been one of the producers. It might have been Peter Eaton.
Mm.
Might have lent him or given him a copy of Rabelais' Gargantua. And that will have probably, you know, turned Spike on to the idea that, you know, this that there is a world of literature out there which needs to be drawn upon. Obviously, he became friends with Robert Graves in later life.
Yes.
Yeah. Boy, didn't he write some stuff. Aye, Claudius, you know, the Lancastrian version.
I read Goodbye to All That years ago.
Yeah. Are you glad you said Goodbye to All That? Or
I didn't really enjoy it.
No, there we are then. I think I did. I had Claudius and Claudius the God. I plowed through them because I thought I should. I felt better when they were finished. Yes.
I don't know if I've told the story on here. Probably have already. Oh. But my dad bought home a video he'd rented from the shop in great excitement. Because he thought it was I, Claudius, which he'd seen on TV many years before, and he thought, I'd like to watch that again.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't I, Claudius. Mm. It was Caligula. Yeah. Which he watched open mouthed.
sort of thing that wouldn't have happened in my household. I don't think that. Says Robert, we're not watching that mucky rubbish. Yes, absolutely.
It was an easy mistake, I suppose.
That was his story, anyway. That's what he told
me. I thought it was
Claudius. I clef divs. The bit as well with when Seagoon is introduced to who we assume is Grip Pipe Thin. Mm. You know, name Seagoon, sex, yes, please. And he says, and Grip Pipe says, what made you join the army? And he says, an armed escort and two military policemen, which reminded me very much of the man who won the war from the first episode of Series 6.
And Spike uses that in Adolf Hitler, My Partner's Downfall, as well. That's, you know, it's a big resonance there, yes. Yep. He was totally, yes, an armed escort and two military policemen. Yes, that's, you know, he was made to call up all of these Ohms letters that just kept arriving. Ohms. A letter marked Ohms. I drove it around the room. Ohms, Ohms.
There's a mention of Diana Dawes.
Yeah, not on the LP.
No.
Not on the LP. Right. Yes, indeed, yeah. Diana being very much still around in 1981 when that was released or whenever it was.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. So, yes, no, they snip out the standard cultural references. And sometimes, of course, you know, I mean, 1956, 1957, she was on the up, most definitely, and she was going to be trying to, you know, become a Hollywood star. She always never quite made it, which I think is a crying shame because I think she was very talented.
She's very good in... Is it Yield to the Night?
Yield to the Night, yes, indeed. Yeah. Absolutely.
But I remember her chiefly from my youth as being in The Worm That Turned.
Well, absolutely. And yes, we're back to Ron and Ron again, absolutely. Mm. Yes, I remember her being slightly terrifying in that. I also remember, of course, in Adamant, Prince Charming. Yes, she was in Prince Charming video as well.
And she's in which one is it? Stepped on Sun, Ride Again, I think.
Ride Again, absolutely, yes.
And her husband just died, literally.
And yes, absolutely. And, you know, there is a scene with Harry, you know, he's, take what you like. Is there anything you can see that you like? Anyway, let's move on.
Yes.
yes, indeed, I remember that moment.
So, is there anything else that we haven't discussed that you want to...
Let's have a think. Musical breaks in it. I'm trying to think what they were.
We got Max playing When You're Smiling.
Very well indeed. That's an interesting one. That's a schizophrenic arrangement. You know, basically it starts off, you know, standard chuntering thing, and then it just goes into this this bossa nova beat, which is glorious. You know, I love the orchestration on that one.
That's
a nice thing. And then we've got Stranded in the Jungle by Ray Ellington and the Quartet. And I always love it when something different happens during one of his breaks. It's not my favorite of his songs, you know, but he sings, he speaks his way through it, you know, he narrates this thing. And then there's, you know, the choruses where the band come back in. In the background, you can hear the goons are sort of like making jungle noises.
Yes.
Jungle native noises. And at the one point, you actually hear Min start to come in as well. You know, and I always love it when I hear that in the background. It means that the goons haven't left the stage. They're still there. They're lurking around in the background and having a bit of fun.
Now the boys in the jungle have me on the run when something hit me like an atomic bomb.
And I love hearing those. What is the one... Is This the Way? Ray Ellington sings on, I can't remember which show it is now. Ray, towards the end of the song, he starts to, you know, just scat, you know, do some scat vocals. Like that. And then Spike comes on, like,
that's right.
And does that and completely floors him. Absolutely corpses him. It's just, you know, it's wonderful to hear that. I love it when things like that happen during the musical breaks, most definitely. And the play out on this one, on the restored version, is glorious. All of those, you know, those ones, when I heard them on the LPs and whatever else 40 years ago, you know, you'd always get a little bit of it at the end, and that's it. You know, they cut it short.
That's right.
They wouldn't have crazy rhythm after it or anything like it. And, you know, it's at this point, you know, the boys start to cut loose in the band. Or in the quartet or whatever else. You think, yeah, that's ace.
Let's have some more of that, please. They did a couple of those when they did the reruns on Pick of the Goons and the BBC in the early 80s as well. You know, a couple of extra play-out bits at the end, and I thought, yeah, can I have a bit of this, please?
Which is the best to you, anyway? What's your favourite? Because we had Goons, Gallop,
and we had Strike. Yeah, that's an interesting one, because Goons Gallop's great, because it's got that wonderful big swoop at the beginning of it, that and you think, this is exciting. It's great. But I love Lucky Strike probably more than that.
I do too, yeah.
I think I found, you know, like a Wally Stott studio recording of that recently, which is beautiful. You know, it stands up now just as a piece of music on its own. But it is very, very difficult, you know, when you're starting to listen to it, to actually not start saying, that was the Goon Show, a BBC recorded programme over the top of it. You know, one finds oneself doing it. And quite unashamedly as well. And why not?
And why not?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, Graham, I think we have exhausted the topic of the nasty affair of at the Barami Oasis.
I think I'm exhausted too, yes.
Yeah, because as I said to you before we started recording, I have just come off the back of a rather eventful party yesterday for my birthday coming up, and so I've got a bit of a morning head as we're recording this, so I'm not firing on all cylinders.
It is no afternoon. Go and rehydrate, young sir.
I will rehydrate. Graham, listen, thank you so much once again.
Pleasure.
You bring such enthusiasm and knowledge and great impressions to every recording.
Oh, stop that.
shut up, you. It's perfectly quiet to you, Kevin. And of course, you know, I'm sure that we will meet again for the purposes of Goonpod at some point.
Please.
Anything you want to... You've got nothing to promote, have you? Let's face it.
I've got nothing to promote. No, I'm still alive. If anybody remembers me from 40 years ago, get in touch. From the Goon Show Society. The nice thing is that, you know, I rejoined the GSPS about a year or two ago. Mm. And it is wonderful to find yourself plunging headlong back into all those little bits of archive minutiae, including the wonderful bit of stuff that's actually appeared in the last couple of weeks. People have been looking for this for a long, long time. Stuff about the Goonist movement.
The Goonist movement, yeah.
And did you see the news on this?
Yeah,
this
Duncan last couple Gray of weeks? Shared that, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. An entire run of all of the newsletters from 1956. Brilliant. How's that, eh?
Brilliant.
It's still all out there. Now, what we need next, if anybody is rummaging in their loft sometime and they find something covered in dust, it probably isn't Granny. Or Min. If you ever see anything like, you know, 16-inch coarse groove discs with BBC written on them, please do let us know. You know, things like Crazy People written on it.
Oh, so I know.
That'd be kind of nice, wouldn't it? Eh?
It would be. It would be.
check your loft for all transcription service rubbish. And you think to yourself, Oh, yes, my dad used to work at the BBC back in the early 1950s, yes. There's some records under that.
He's only got series 1 to 4, though.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's underneath that pile of Marconi AXBT microphones, yeah. And Cliff Mitchell more.
By the way, speaking of the GSPS, I don't know, did you see the latest issue of the Goon Show magazine?
I flicked through it. I've not had a chance to look at it properly yet. What's in it?
Yes, your bit in it.
Oh, yes, I saw the photograph of you. My, you handsome devil, you.
Thank you.
Yes.
I wrote a piece, as they say, for the magazine about the origins of the podcast and...
Yeah.
Stuff like
indeed.
That.
So. And it's still going, and nobody's written to the Times about it yet.
Well, the podcast has been mentioned in the Times.
I know. That's why I said it. I know, good man. But there's not been any questions mentioned in Parliament about it yet, so that's good. This is good.
But in any case, listen, Graham, always a joy, always a pleasure. Come back again soon.
I will. Thank you, Tyler.
We're going to send a gunboat!